I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. This time on the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, we have Dr. Mark Prince joining us. Dr. Prince is an associate professor and associate director of addiction counseling in the Department of Psychology at Colorado State University. He's going to be talking to us about his interesting work on protective behavioral strategies, and also is just one of the best people in the business. So we're delighted to have him on the show.
All right. We're really happy to have you, Dr. Mark Prince. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thrilled to be with you. Thrilled to have you here. I'm sure Noah is thrilled to have someone who may be right down the hallway from him right now. Before we jump into the substantive section, the meat of the episode today, we want to hear a little bit about your training. Can you tell us about your training background?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I started at Columbia University as an undergrad. I was actually a physics major, and I switched to psychology about midstream, and the first psychology professor I worked with was Carol Dweck. I worked with her over in Harlem in the middle schools and junior high schools on a mentoring program studying the malleability of intelligence, and incredible opportunity to work with her and her team, and just to be thrown into a new environment and feel like I was contributing to something at an early stage. I also worked with Janet Metcalf, who is primarily a cognitive psychologist up in the South Bronx, studying how people learn in a dual language environment. This is also in the schools. So both really different from the work I do now, but got me started and excited about research in the field of psychology. Then after undergrad, I moved out to San Diego. I worked in a group home for a little while, and then I got a job at UCSD working with Sandy Brown on two longitudinal studies where we recruited adolescents age 12 to 18 from inpatient treatment and followed them to age 35. And this was really a cool experience because we weren't trying to have any impact on their behavior. It was just a basically clinical course research. One study was substance use only, and the other was substance use and mental health comorbidities. And then in addition to interviewing them, we also interviewed a resource person who was usually a parent and or a grandparent. And so I got to spend time with people from, age 12 up into their 70s at all points in the substance, through the clinical course of substance use. Sometimes I'd go interview someone 10 or 12 years after they started, they hadn't used in ages, don't even barely remember those times. Other times I didn't, interview someone who was much older and it was still struggling. And what that really did was gave me a great bird's eye view on the field. And, the opportunity I learned, got to learn got my neuropsych training from Susan Tapert. And it was these 8-hour battery structured interviews, neuropsych assessments. And I just gained such a deep passion for this, for folks struggling with these issues. They're good people. Usually, their life maybe had gone astray a little bit, but they were out there trying to do good things, make their lives better, and not having the pressure of being the agent of change at that early stage was so valuable for me. While I was there, I did a master's at San Diego State, where I got the chance to do my thesis and then eventually publish on some of the data I'd been helping to collect. And that's where I got exposed to statistics for the first time. And then after I finished my master's program, I moved to Syracuse, which was actually where I grew up, and did a PhD in clinical psychology with Kate Carey, was the person that recruited me. She eventually left and went to Brown, and I finished with Steve Maistow. And then I also did an applied statistics master's concurrently. And, while I was at Syracuse, I had a lot of great opportunities to do you know, work as an interventionist on brief motivational interventions. I got to work on a Native American reservation for a couple of years, which was profoundly impactful on my life. I worked in outpatient clinics, again, in schools, and also got to do some more advanced quantitative training, which I think has opened a ton of doors for me. I'm happy to talk more about later. Then on internship, I went to Brown and worked with Rick Brown and Anna Brontes, and also got great clinical training at Women and Infants Hospital, drug and alcohol partial program, and behavioral medicine rotations, and then long-term OCD treatment with Maria Mancebo. And then from there, I went to the Research Institute on Addictions for postdoc, where I worked with Lorraine Collins, which is the point where I transitioned from alcohol to cannabis research. And also got more into EMA research with Lorraine. And then I also worked with Gerard Connors doing therapeutic alliance research and rural mental health research. And got the opportunity to connect with folks like Jen Reed and Craig Colder, looking at the transition from college into adulthood, and just all kinds of fantastic people at Buffalo. And then from there, I ended up at CSU, Colorado State, to help launch our addiction counseling program. And so, you know, it was a little bit of a windy road like most of us have, but I feel so blessed and honored to have worked with all these great people that have, you know, helped me to see the field well and develop my own line of research.
Agreed. Yeah, it's a real who's who list of characters there, right? You got even just like some of the people who are like subtly involved, like the shout out Susan Tapert, who's like the PI on the ABCD trial now.
Right.
She's amazing. I always love it. Chance to bump into Susan when I can at a conference.
Yeah, it's a wild list. We've had at least, I might be mistaken, at least one of those people here on the podcast, Lorraine Collins, who talked about EMA.
We had
has
Anna
done
on
some
the show.
Awesome research. Anna, right, as well.
We had
has
Anna
been
on
the
show as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a few. Great. So, Jen Reed also.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm at the alcohol drug program right now. So it's
literally
funny. I'm getting this that training right now. So it's been awesome. Fantastic experience. I can attest.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. I also did my rotation ADP, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah.
Absolutely
I feel like loved. we should have been carving our names in the desk or something like that. Get a running list of everyone who's gone through it. It's a lot of
here,
people.
You know?
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. There's Jen Reed went there when she was an intern.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a real who's who list. Also shout out Kate Carey, who hasn't been on the show, but like many people who've been on the show have been impacted by her mentorship. And
yeah.
Really,
really
one of the biggest contributions in addition to her research is just the mentorship that she's provided the field. Right. And, you know, Kate Carey was the mentor for my advisor too. So Mark and I are actually, I guess I'm his academic nephew, technically.
There you go. Right? That's right. Yeah.
That's right.
Family. So,
yeah, it's a real, it's actually the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon in the addiction field has a few real nodes that hold it together. Brown, right? A few specific mentors along the way, San Diego, obviously, places like that. And so that's why it's so interesting to listen to people's background on here and also just kind of hear the lens in which, you know, your research is informed through and so forth. And so, you know, we know that you've covered a lot of space, even just in your description of your background, right? Like how much the types of work that you've been involved in, you know, and your work covers, you know, a lot of areas in substance use from advanced quantitative approaches, as you've already kind of identified, you know, to psychosocial determinants of substance use and intervention development. And so today we kind of wanted to focus in our discussion on your work understanding protective behavioral strategies. And so for those who are unfamiliar, could you just explain what protective behavioral strategies are and why they're important?
Absolutely. Protective behavioral strategies are cognitive or behavioral strategies a person can use to either reduce their use of the substance, the quantity or frequency, or to reduce their risk of consequences. And they're important because they're the mechanism of change in addiction treatment. If we think about, you know, someone who makes a change in their life, what did they actually do to achieve that change? Anything that you could describe in there would fall under the umbrella of protected behavioral strategies.
Nice. So these are kind of like things that happen in the moment, right? When a person's mm-hmm. making a decision about use, let's say, and how they might engage with the individual substance, or how they might, you know, set their environment up to reduce kind of unwanted negative consequences, you know, things like, you know, drinking water between your drinks to, you know, curate a specific blood alcohol concentration, right? Or, you know, using things like designated drivers or things like that, that might reduce a risk of a specific negative consequence, things like that. But also mm-hmm. setting up plans for yourself about how much you're going to drink, who you're going to drink with, things like this is, I think, not uncommon for people to understand in the context of addiction, but might not have put it underneath this kind of umbrella of these protective behavioral strategies, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think that those are great examples. And, you know, also avoidance strategies, which a lot of times aren't on the list and the scales that we use. But a lot of times that's the best strategy you could possibly use. Just don't go to the party, or don't get high.
Yeah, abstinence is like the purest protective behavioral strategy, right? Like mm-hmm. that's on one end of the spectrum, whereas on the other end is like, I'm not going to drink to blackout. Right. Yeah.
Or if I do, I'll make sure that I have people watching over me and a ride home.
Yeah.
You know, and so any of those things could fall under protective behavioral strategies, and they can be tricky to operationalize and measurement. You know, I've done some work on measurement development. I'm happy to talk about if folks would be interested. But yeah, in general, that's what people, you know, when we talk about PBS, that's what they are.
Gotcha. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got into this line of research and what interests you most about it.
Sure. So a paper that I don't think gets referenced enough is Carey and Maestow, 1985. They did a review of self-control strategies. And, you know, I think in the early 80s and 70s, that's how people thought about a lot about these things as self-control strategies. So I started my PhD program in 2008, and by the time I was getting ready to write a review paper for my comprehensive exam, the field had really grown. There was a lot of research. Matt Martins had developed a protective behavioral strategies scale, and there'd been a lot of research growing up, primarily in the alcohol field. And you know, it was time to do another review. And so, yeah, it was my, you know, it was super hard as a third year grad student to do a review paper, but probably one of the most valuable exercises I ever did. It forced me to read an entire literature and understand, like, you know, what do we know? What do we not know? What are some areas that the field can move in? And it set me off on this path. And, you know, that paper was published in 2013, so it's been almost 10 years. And I would say just now, some of the things I'm doing were things I first thought about writing that review paper. And so it was, you know, Matteo published a review the same year. He found twice as many studies as me. I don't want to read into that too much, but
that lines up also with just my experience of Matt Pearson, is who we're talking about. For anybody who knows him, you know exactly what we're talking about.
But you know, my review really focused on measurement issues. And at that time, there were all these competing scales. Some were only strategies you use during the drinking episode. Others included avoidance strategies. Others were, you know, just investigator developed random lists. There was like all kinds of things and no rhyme or reason to it. And so, you know, I think for me, not just learning about PBS and the state of the science at that time, but even just thinking hard about what does it mean to measure these things? What does it mean to take a total score or an average and correlate it with some count of consequences or whatever? A lot of these issues that I think we still wrestle with, I started to think about at that time.
Yeah, in 1985, I guess, is that review paper. Around that time, mm-hmm. like from what, you know, I was actually, you know, I don't know how much I want to reveal here, but I definitely wasn't doing research at that time.
No, nor was I don't think anybody here was really.
No one was
not that kind of research.
Right, right. Yeah, you're figuring out the world and stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, like the approach was, I mean, even to this day in treatment programs, it's largely abstinence based. And that, you know, I'm in an abstinence based program now, and it can be, it's still useful to at times talk about protective behavioral strategies, but there's a little bit less room. And at that time, you know, harm reduction just wasn't really a major focus. So introducing this concept of protective behavioral strategies is really important, introducing harm reduction in general, because the vast majority of people who, I think it's like 6% or 5% of people with an alcohol use disorder actually like go out and seek treatment. And a lot of people who don't actually want any treatment. So to find ways to help people reduce those harms based on just switching up the order of their drinks or you know, throwing in the water or whatever, that could, you know, across a lot of people represent a major public health intervention. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit, Mark, about how you've seen it incorporated in different settings and how you've used it clinically.
Yeah, well, I think that historical context is important. You have, you know, Mark and Linda Sobel doing the first controlled drinking studies in the late 70s. Marlatt, his relapse prevention book is coming out, you know, early 80s. And yeah, so I was born in 1980. So, you know, that was before my time as well. But I found that history is really important in my teaching. I always give the history, and I've thought, and I actually think your podcast is doing a great job of, we're at a critical moment right now where we still have the legends and the originators around, you know, before, you know, the 70s, there wasn't a ton in the addiction field. And, you know, since those early pioneers into what I would think of as like modern addiction science, you know, over the last, whatever, 40 years, we've seen a, you know, massive growth, and our methods and everything have just come into the modern age. And I think we actually do better than a lot of other fields of thinking really hard and closely and using rigorous methods. But anyway, I don't get too far off on that tangent. I think your question was, you know, how do I use PBS in my clinical work, and what are types of some applications I've seen it applied in? You know, I do still see clients. I'm a licensed psychologist, and you know, in my weekly sessions with clients, it's really an ongoing conversation. I want to understand, what are the consequences you want to avoid? What are the contexts that you use in? And let's work together to come up with a strategy or a set of strategies that will work best for you. And it may be that one strategy works great at a party, but that same strategy does not work very well when you're home and feeling sad, or when you're feeling anxious and going, you know, grocery shopping or whatever it might be. And so being realistic with them and not assuming that they can just do it, that I can be like, oh yeah, you know, alternate alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages. Like you said, it sounds easy enough. Like I should say, go do it. But what does that mean for someone going to a party? Maybe you're carrying around your solo cup, and every time you finish a drink, you go fill it up with water and then drink that before you fill it up again with, you know, with beer again or something. And really getting into the weeds with them, seeing like what would be the barriers, or they may be embarrassed to do that, or that may not be the right strategy for that person or that context. And I think really that's where the rubber meets the road, is for these to be effective, people have to actually use them, and they have to be matched to the situation that they're in and the consequences they want to avoid.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I also think importantly, I think these protective behavioral strategies really show up mostly in like individual sessions more than anything, unless you're doing a group about like harms related to it. But like, I feel like programs struggle oftentimes to negotiate how to implement harm reduction strategies in these larger contexts that have been historically abstinence based and these types of things. And so I think it requires this kind of like ongoing conversation about like, how did it go? Mm-hmm. Oh, that wasn't what you're looking for. Maybe we toggle it down a little bit. And I think it shows up a lot in like college campuses, right? If you think of, you know, programs like Basics, I think are largely based on it. And, you know, like I've done therapy like that before, like, you know, young people are like largely not interested in abstinence in my experience. They're like, what are you talking about, dude? I'm like 19 years old, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that they're going to be like abstinent forever is just like kind of hard for them to even conceptualize. And so, you know, when you walk them through, it's like, well, what do you not like about it? What do you like about it? And, you know, I've done things as much as like trying to help calculate a person's blood alcohol concentration using, you know, these like hand calculators to help a person figure out like, oh, well, when did you black out? Oh, at point, you know, two. Okay. So how can we keep you below that? And then like, oh, you still blacked out. Maybe we're going to tone it down a little bit. Maybe we're going to change it. Things like that, that really require kind of a rinse and repeat and seeing like what's most effective for that person in those contexts. And I think that matching process really requires, you know, clinical judgment and also, you know, participation on the part of the individual. And, you know, maybe you back into an abstinence-based approach in some context for some people, because it's just, that's what's most functional and effective for them. But I think that there's a lot of tension between these kind of like larger programs and what you might be able to pull off in an individual therapy session. As you've noted, you know, if we were doing this in, you know, ADP at Brown, you know, Butler Hospital, you know, protective behavioral strategy would largely be frowned upon, right, by the larger context, right? And you'd have to negotiate that.
So I did have a way I snuck it into our functional analysis group. And I don't know if you're still doing that one.
I'm doing it tomorrow.
You should do it twice a week.
Hit me with it.
Yeah,
hit me with it, Mark.
Yeah. So Tuesday and Thursday. I draw up along the board, you know, all the, you know, the situation, the triggers, the thoughts, the emotions, the, you know, the behavior, the consequences, short term, long term, positive, negative consequences. So we go through, fill up the whole board. And then I would go back to the beginning. And the first thing I would do is I had a column that, well, I never was able to come up with a great title for it. I would sometimes call it like precursors or like kind of risk and protective factors. And so it would be blank the whole time and everyone would be wondering what it was. It was right before triggers. And I would say, you know, what are the things that make you more vulnerable to your triggers? What are the things that make it so you can...
Yes.
Handle them better, you know, and
vulnerability factors, something like that.
You know, if you're hungry,
antecedents of substance use, I think is what they're called in the relapse prevention, right?
Yeah,
but what they always in the sheet you get in the folder from ADP, I think they call them warning signs.
Yeah, that's a good one too. But it's like you're tired, you're hungry, you're in a bad mood, you just ran into your ex. You know, these are things that ahead of time you can know. If I didn't get a good sleep last night, I might be more vulnerable to my triggers.
Absolutely. So
we go through that. And then as we look at the functional analysis sequence, we would talk about ways you could break the link at every spot. You know, you have a thought, what could you do to not have that result in a behavior? Or you have an emotional reaction. How could you cope with that in a way other than using? And so we would have conversations that involved PBS throughout that sequence, but without losing the idea of functional analysis, which was to, you know, understand,
right,
you know, what
well, there are those little, absolutely, those tiny little interventions, sort of self-perpetuated interventions that maybe can break that chain. And I really love, Mark, what you were saying about flexibility. Like, I don't think that can be stressed enough. Just as time goes on, being aware of that and wondering what needs to change, how things might be different between people, but also like within person, different situations. And then over time too, just as your life changes and things become different. I think that's a really important point as well.
Agreed. And anybody who's listening, who's interested in functional analysis, Carl Lejeune wrote a really great paper on this in The Behavior Therapist, that we can, post a link to, but it really helps you walk through for anybody who's interested who doesn't know how to do functional analysis. There's a really great kind of tutorial by Carl Lejeune that walks you through how to fill some of this stuff out for those who might be interested in maybe doing this in a group context or in individual therapy, who hasn't had an opportunity to really train in that. Cause I know that like I've thought about it a lot before I got to internship, but I had never to deploy it in the context like we're talking about here, where you've got a board and you're doing your whole thing and you got 20 people with all kinds of different stuff going on, which was, I think, just really helpful for me to take a peek at some of the literature on this stuff. And so for anybody who's interested, we can post those kinds of things along the way. And so, Mark, I think you've had like a really, I think, okay, you've gotten like the bird's eye view of this thing in review papers. You've been involved in, you know, a bunch of, you know, empirical work on this. You've done it clinically. And so I was wondering if you could just kind of walk us through, you know, maybe how your thinking's kind of evolved on these issues over time and maybe lead us to a little bit what the, you know, where we are with this stuff.
Sure. So when I first got into the field, like I said, that it was just growing. We were starting to see sort of pretty consistent evidence that there was a negative association between PBS use frequency and alcohol use and consequences. And, you know, some of the work I did with Adrian Bravo, also on the podcast before,
that's right,
and Mateo Pearson, you know, a lot of it was looking at in different samples, looking at mediators, moderators, trying to just see how comfortable we could feel saying PBS was a mechanism of change. One of my first talks was at the Mechanisms of Change pre-conference on, and you know, at that point we had, you know, evidence for maybe three quarters of the criteria. And now I think we're closing in on almost all of Kazan and Knox criteria. You know, then I saw the move to going beyond alcohol PBS to cannabis PBS. Mm. And now we've seen, you know, lots of other substances and even, you know, sexual risk taking and other things. And, you know, one open question in the area is there, could you come up with a general PBS scale, or is it more like self-efficacy where there's really no such thing as general PBS, but more, you know, can you protect yourself in a given, you know, do we need a different set of strategies for each substance, for each situation we find ourselves in? And I would bet there are people out there on both sides of that that think there is sort of a general protective behavioral strategies. Like we could generate that scale and it would be meaningful. I think right now we lean a little more the other way, that it's more like self-efficacy where it has to be specific. Mm. And then, you know, the interventions, you know, for me, I do a lot of different kinds of research, but the part that I would say I'm most passionate about is intervention development. But that work is slow for me. I can't just do intervention study after intervention study. I feel like each time, you know, the few times I've done them, I have to like stop and think and look and read and do more analysis before I design the next one. Hmm. And the few studies that have used PBS and interventions have had kind of modest findings. It seems like the effects should be bigger than they are, given that, like, by definition, effective use of strategies should result in reduced use and consequences. And so I just got an R34 funded with Christina Phillips. She's the PI in Kaiser, Honolulu. And we're going to be doing an adaptive ecological momentary intervention where we're for alcohol and cannabis co-use, where we'll be giving recommending protective behavioral strategies to folks in the moment based on 2 weeks of EMA data and then different situational context variables and also random prompt responses in real time. And so I think that's really exciting. And then I have some other work with Eric Peterson that's looking at, you know, how to most efficiently match strategies to consequences and context. And we got a shiny app in development and just got a grant not discussed, which is how those go, to try to do this in a face-to-face context where we have used this app to you know, guide clinician conversations around PBS and then have a follow-up to see kind of what worked and what didn't. But I'm not going to give up on that. You know, a lot of times you got to submit grants a few times before you can articulate yourself well enough for reviewers to get what you're trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think first of all, yeah, don't give up. Sounds like a good idea. Sometimes it's just not the right reviewer, but, the just-in-time stuff, it seems like is, you know, I guess the theory behind, brief interventions, right, which usually protective behavioral strategies rear their head in that setting, is that the person definitely doesn't want to experience some things, but still wants to drink or use, right? And so being able to say like, hey, by the way, this often happens when you do what you're about to do, you know, if you, especially if you get the timing right.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like the best way to address this specific issue and help implement PBS at like a greater level.
Yeah, and we don't want to be annoying either, right? And so we can use the EMA data to see like, okay, this person tends to drink on Friday and Saturday night. And so the prompt will come at 5 o'clock Friday night, you know, maybe 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon with like, hey, you know, your goal was this, you know, maybe, you might want to try this strategy. It's been helpful for folks.
Right.
Or someone else who gets high before work every day. And, you know, we may know from the baseline sessions that that's something they want to avoid. We may send those prompts at 6:30 to say, you know, consider going for a walk before work or something. Right. And so we just, you know, this is just the trial's just starting. The first phase is developing it, dialing in all the adaptive portions. And then we're going to have some folks pilot test it, community members, and then do interviews with them to refine it. And so it's a 3-year project. I'm so excited about it. But definitely a lot of moving parts.
Oh, yeah, agreed.
Yeah, that sounds really complicated. Do you have like a computer programmer or something?
We do, actually. We have Trent Lalonde, who's a PhD in stats. He was the chair of the statistics department of University of Northern Colorado, and then became a dean and recently has moved more into industry. He's, you know, at stats conferences, he'll be on symposia with Donald Hedeker and Saul Schiffman and all those folks. So yeah, we got him in the mix to do the heavy lifting on this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the hardest parts about it, right? And I think one of the things here, I think that's really important is, you know, for all the people that we work with who are interested in making a change in anything, but especially in substance use, you know, these people are really smart and resilient people who, you know, have survived years doing things that potentially put their health at risk. But implementation of these new strategies that are designed to disrupt these habitual kind of ingrained patterns of use and context kind of associations is really challenging, right? Like implementation, like when I talk to people and I do like, you know, therapy with them, they're like, they get it. They're like, yes, that makes sense to me. But when I'm out on Friday with my boys, I don't think about that.
Right.
Like that's not at all in my awareness. Right. And maybe over time of rinse and repeat, like reminders and sessions that maybe it comes about. But the idea behind a just-in-time intervention, right, is like, if you can't show up to my office when you're at the greatest risk, perhaps we can bring the office to you when you're at greatest risk. Right. And if we also, if we're able to really isolate when you are at greatest risk, because not everybody's really great at identifying those particular pressure points and how long they're at risk and these factors, right? Like 2 o'clock PM Saturday, you know, it's maybe 7 o'clock PM on Friday, right? And like that has a different window of risk. And so like isolating those things and then being able to push to them through their mobile devices, which most people at this point carry with them everywhere they go, I think really sets a person up to be able to figure out at least which one of these are most effective at disrupting this relationship, because it may not be a one-to-one, right? And I think that's an important part here is that Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, you gave a talk once upon a time. We did a symposium together in Denver, surprisingly, APA, where you talked about some data that you had working with Lorraine, where it was, you know, it wasn't necessarily like how many you use, but like finding one that really works was like kind of the gist there. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So, this was a RCT that Lorraine Collins had run as was wrapping up as I was a postdoc at RIA and analyzing this data. Well, first of all, we see Simpson's paradox a lot in PBS. That's where you have the between person effects and the within person effects in opposite directions. So people, you know, people who use more strategies tend to be those who say drink more, use more. The data Noah's talking about is actually cannabis. We see it with cannabis too, use more cannabis, have more problems. And that's just because there's more opportunities to use those strategies.
Yeah.
But on the within level, in a moment where you chose to use a strategy, you use less cannabis. We found on average about like a half a gram less of cannabis, which was pretty substantial. And, you know, those in a, we even ran a three level model and added some perceived effectiveness ratings. And really, you could distill the effect down to, it was those people who were able to use an effective strategy in the moment that was driving the negative associations that you would see on average, say, in a cross-sectional study. And I don't think that the you know, all the nuances of Simpson's paradox in the PBS field have been teased apart yet. I'd love to do that paper. But I do think it's there, and it kind of brings back to some of the things I was saying earlier about what matters is the ability to select and effectively use a strategy in the moment, which can be more challenging than it sounds. And also helps explain the modest or weak relationships in some studies, because, you know, you could have somebody out there. Yeah. You could have one. Yeah. Someone using one who does it every time, especially if that is like that strategy is don't use and has no consequences, or someone who has a, you know, sets a limit of three drinks and never has a hangover, you know, never has any negative consequences. And then you could have someone else who's out there trying a dozen strategies poorly and has tons of consequences. And so, you know, this is one of the measurement issues that we still wrestle with, and I think obfuscates our effects, is that this idea that more strategies more often is better is not necessarily true.
Yeah, I mean, that's often how they calculate, though, like some of those
just
scales,
a raw
right?
sum.
Yeah, just like sum, how many of these things are you using, especially when you're looking at like between person effects, right? But like when we try to pull those over to within person kind of moment to moment changes, right, these kind of like sum scores actually produce can produce you know, different directions across the two levels depending on how they calculate it, right? And that's the classic kind of like burn that happens there, right? And so like that, I really think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about that, was just like that really like stuck to me, especially when I work clinically with people. It's like, yo, we have the, like, there's lists out there for anybody who's interested. You can find these lists of protective behavioral strategies, like in Martin's and Mark's papers. There are these lists, you know, I think Eric Peterson perhaps has the cannabis one, but it has a bunch of things you do, right? And then it's like trying to isolate individual ones that might be the most effective for you, perhaps is going to be an easiest implementation strategy, right? Like all you got to do is remember that one thing. Versus like, oh, there's like 18 of these different things. And like, which one of them makes the most sense to plug in and play right now? It can be pretty tough, especially if you've had a couple drinks or a couple rips, where you're going to be like, oh shit. You know, maybe my memory isn't super great right now. Maybe I'm also in a situation where I can't like pull up this list that you have for me, right? Yeah. Like I'm at the bar or whatever. It might not make sense. And so that's one of the reasons why that really, I think, struck me, is just like, it's about how effective it is in addition to like how to match them. Right. And those things are related.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll say on the measurement issue is we desperately need a good EMA PBS list, because right now, you know, one of the things is our, you know, most of the time when we ask about consequences, it's past 30 day consequences. And the PBS lists we have are really geared towards that. The best item on the, say, the cannabis PBS scale is don't use habitually, which is a great, great thing if you're trying to predict 30-day like, consequences, right. But that doesn't help me in the moment.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, and some of the problems that we have on our problems list, then this is, I think, and you all both do EMA research more than I do, but some of them are fairly low base rate. You look at 30 days and, you know, maybe they didn't get enough like physical altercation with someone and, you know, last night drinking, but maybe if you did once in the last year, that's still a fairly big deal. So
severity. Yeah. We need severity ratings on consequences scale. Totally. We've collected some of that data. We haven't published on it. But yeah, similar to the perceived helpfulness or effectiveness with PBS and severity of consequences, yeah, I think there's definitely important substantive questions to be asked beyond just like the count. How many consequences did you experience? How frequently did you use these PBS? And I think we're, you know, the field is moving in that direction. I think in general, people doing this research are, we have more confidence in the robustness of the findings. Our thinking has become clearer over time. And I'm still excited. I think there's still a lot to do in this area.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah, I remember, I think it was Mateo was talking about it at RSMJ, so the Research Society on Marijuana in Boston this year, where they've like been looking for the variable that like breaks the association here, right? But like part of it, I think, is really important in this, noted in like things like functional analysis that don't show up in the way that we collect data, which is like these different consequences have both different short-term and long-term effects, right? So like some, and they're a lot more variable between people, right? Mm-hmm. And moment to moment, right? So like, you know, one of these things is super rare, but if it happens, it's really bad, right? Where another thing happens a lot more frequently, but also isn't that bad. And some things that happen really frequently are really bad. And so they have different footprints on your life, different immediacy and certainty. They have different, you know, these things. And we haven't totally wrestled that stuff to the ground yet. And so I think from a research perspective, we probably still have some work to do. Mark, what do you think, you know, are the things that really need, that need still need to be done in this space that perhaps we haven't talked about already?
You know, so just to reiterate something I said before, it's, you know, it's not discouraging. It's like disheartening that the interventions that have been published don't have these strong effects, because, you know, I think looking for something that breaks the PBS relationship is tricky, since, like I said, by definition, if you do these things, they result in less use and fewer consequences. And so we should be seeing these huge effects. And so understanding, you know, what's getting in the way, I think that they're figuring out how to train people to be able to use them, give them, you know, maybe set up scenarios so people could practice them, or some of the stuff that we've started to do with making suggestions in real time, or you know, just trying to bring it into their real life. At the end of the day, there's, you know, as a clinician or as a scientist, you know, what my client chooses to do is not in my control. And so, you know, we have to encourage them. I think there's still motivational interviewing applications here to build their intrinsic motivation to do these things, and then be there with them non-judgmentally to help them make good decisions and learn from, like, man, you know, I tried the thing that we talked about and it totally backfired. I, you know, I set my limit at 35 drinks and like I almost got there, you know. You know, that's not exactly how it works. We're trying to set a low limit. And then go back, try it again, you know. And so it's you know, I think some of it is we don't even understand where these things fall apart. You know, how is it, you know, is it that they're not doing them? Is it that they're trying and failing? Is it that, like, you know, no, I think you were the one that said, you know, after you have a few drinks, it becomes a lot harder. How do we get into that space? You know, so there's a lot of, I think, a lot of pieces that we can do to just empower people to take control of their lives.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, I'll bring in sort of my behavioral economic perspective for a moment. It's that the when you're sitting in a room with someone and talking about what you want, you know, next weekend or something like that, maybe the value of not having that extra drink is greater than the value of actually having that drink. But then in the moment, you know, I don't know philosophically if it matters if, like, they actually, you know, now want the drink, or if they just can't control themselves. But, you know, most people, for whatever reason, the value actually does shift in, like, drinking another drink because all of your friends are taking a shot together and they want you to take a shot with them. And actually in that moment, it's more important for you to continue to connect with the social group because they're your primary social group at college than it is to not drink that shot. You know, it's like they could be doing the protective behavioral strategies. They could be doing it sort of less, or they could actually change their mind in the moment for a legitimate reason. I think so. Another part of it is understanding and making sense, I guess, of why they would actually choose not to do that in the moment, even if they maybe actually did want to do it in another moment.
Yeah. Or being realistic with yourself, right? If you know, you can learn, and I think with clients, you can talk to them about like, maybe it's not, maybe you're going to take that shot. And so rather than, you know, pretending like you're not going to, let's put some backup strategies in place. Let's make sure you have a designated driver. Let's make sure you have, you know, you are, you know, with friends and people that are, can help look out for you. Maybe you're going to take the shot and then, you know, drink some water, keep an eye on the clock, make sure to give yourself some time before you have another drink. You know, there's a lot of ways we could troubleshoot if we know that that's what happens.
Likely. It's like,
I don't want to be the one to say, nah, like I'm good. If that's your client, then you can work with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I literally have a tattoo for a reason like this. Right. And so like the tides here are strong. Right. I think, I think it's also important if we go back to functional analysis, right. The idea that like the positive consequences of substance use are immediate and certain. Mm-hmm. Right. And the positive consequences of change are usually distal and uncertain. Right. That not everybody experiences the same positive consequences, and they tend to take a long ass time before they kick in. And so like that tension there produces in you susceptibility to the tides of the moment.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And there's like not really a benefit to not experiencing a consequence. You know what? Does that make sense?
Yeah, the absence like, is not inherently not positive, right?
Right.
Not, for some people, eventually, as you accumulate enough consequences, then the absence of it is a positive feeling. But for people who find themselves in these types of situations we just described, that's unlikely, right? Unless a person has like, you know, alcohol use disorder and they stacked up a bunch. You know, people I work with who are, you know, involved in the criminal legal system or, you know, or have, you know, child care related issues in the legal system, right? Like the absence of those things do inherently produce positive emotional consequences. Yeah. But moment to moment in a situation like that, where you're in a social situation, you're likely to experience negative emotions as a function of not engaging in that social thing compared to, you know, maybe tomorrow you'll wake up and be like, oh, I'm so glad. Right. But like, that's tomorrow use problem, right? Now use problem is you have to deal with all your friends who now you have a tattoo. You know, in a theoretical world,
you have a tattoo.
I literally have a tattoo that like this. We're all getting tattoos right
that is
now.
That is a consequence of, I see.
Right?
I
Everybody's getting tattoos right now. And it was like, I don't really want a tattoo. Yeah.
The trick to that is to be last in line. So the time
that's exactly
it's your
what
turn.
Everyone's too tired. Yeah, they're
ready
to go.
This is a fun story that I'll tell for a different time. So if you ever see me at a conference, ask me about the tattoo. But because I was last, I could get like the tiniest little tattoo. And then everybody was fine with it because everybody else had already committed to their thing. Right? Mm-hmm. The first person got this giant tattoo. Right. And then it got smaller and smaller as the people went through. Right. And so I have like this tiny little tat that like doesn't even really register as a tattoo, but yet I also get to tell the story. So next time you're at CPA or something like that, and you see me ask me about the tattoo.
Protective behavioral strategies go last in the tattoo line. That's
how it works. Like, that's how it works. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Unlike tattoos, I think protective behavioral strategies, one of the things that's amazing about them is that they're super intuitive when you explain them to people, right? Like how they work makes sense. You know, And that's one of the things I love about them, but really trying to figure out how to make them work when you have multiple pressures in the moment is really, I think, the next frontier for us. And I think that the work that you're doing with Christina and people like that, I think is really just kind of the next horizon that we absolutely must get to really figure out how to help have these work for the most amount of people in the most situations to produce the most amount of benefit. As we think about them, right? Like that's how we conceptualize them, but how to really make that come to life for people, I think is really where we're at.
Yeah. And I just want to, I agree with you. And I want to just like give this like nod to like the challenge of scientist practitioner.
Yeah.
And so like one of the reviewers on the grant with Eric in the same breath said, like, this is just normal, like clinical work. And there's no evidence that PBS interventions work, right? How can both of these things be true?
Yeah.
And it's like, that is exactly like, they're right. And that's the problem is it's very hard to take what you would do with a person sitting across the room from you and turn that into a research protocol or write a treatment manual that, you know, accounts for, you know, all the possible branches in that decision tree. And
yet we do it.
We do it, or we try. I think motivational interviewing is, you know, really brilliant in that it sort of takes that off the table. And it's like more about, this is just how to be with people, how to listen, how to respond to people.
Right.
And then they can bring whatever they want. That's part of why it, you know, works so well across settings. But it's tough to translate what I would do in the therapy space into a research study. And I think it's an ongoing struggle.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. And part of it, you know, is measurement, and part of it is, you know, some of the ways in which these associations really kind of show up for us as we, you know, accumulate years of evidence, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you about a paper we talk a lot about on this show.
Sure.
I brought it up multiple times. I still remain steadfast in the idea that this is the greatest paper that nobody has read. So that's not meant to be a backhanded compliment as much as it is that people need to read this paper. And so I was hoping that maybe if it's okay, we could pivot to it for a second, because I think it's relevant.
Happy to.
Exact conversation. So you published a paper where you looked at the kind of like meta analytic, essentially, effect of drinking and alcohol related consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And you were kind of highlighted some like interesting findings here. And I was hoping maybe you could briefly describe them for our audience so that they can kind of help understand some of the powers that are at play here.
Sure. Well, yeah, I can start by just giving the motivation for writing that paper. Well, first, so I'm a harm reductionist, and so I'm not always interested in how much someone's drinking. I'm more interested in their consequences they're experiencing. And I would have reviewers say, like, you have to control for alcohol use in all your models. There's like a strong, robust association between drinking and consequences, and you need to have these in all your models. And I always felt like, I don't know if that's true, and I want to find out. and then, you know, I actually know that the exact paper that made, like, you know, cross me over the line to like, I'm going to write this paper. It was a paper with Jen Reed and Craig Colder, where we were looking at transitions, trying to predict who would go on to develop alcohol use disorder after they graduate from college. And I really needed this citation that didn't exist. And so I basically emailed everyone I knew and said, you know, send me your alcohol use and consequences data. And I worked with Mateo and Adrian and Kevin Montes, and we pulled together as many studies as we could find. We had a bunch of college student samples, like 30 some college samples, and I think like 9 or 10 big clinical trials. And we looked at the association and all of those studies across between drinking and consequences, and found it's actually a pretty small amount of the variance was explained, you know, like something on the order. I actually jotted it down because you had mentioned you might want to talk about it. 23% of the variance in alcohol related consequences in college students samples was explained by use, and 14% in clinical samples. So that means between 77 and 84% of the variance in problems is not explained by use alone. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's not a trivial number. I mean, we'd be happy with those R squareds, but it doesn't mean, you know, it's definitely not a one-to-one relation that the, you know, how much you drink exactly predicts how many consequences you'll have. And it makes me realize that there's so many other factors involved in between that link between use and consequences that we need to put our energy into understanding better, you know, moderators, mediators of that relationship, context specific factors. There's lots of things that may explain consequences beyond just how much you had to drink.
Yeah, that's a shocking figure. And I think that every time, because of how much we discuss or target consumption as like our primary outcome. And it always, I'll highlight one other person who's been on this show's work, a review that Susan Collins wrote in 2016 in Alcohol Research Current Reviews, Associations Between Socioeconomic Factors and Alcohol Outcomes. I always bring this up because it's it's a reminder to me that, you know, although African-American and white people, you know, are holding things constant, holding alcohol consumption constant, African-American populations tend to have more problems, and often related to all of these other variables that exist. And this is a really complicated issue that we just don't spend enough time discussing.
Agreed. Yeah,
and it's more complicated than that too, because at historically Black colleges and even Black students on colleges that are not historically Black institutions, they tend to drink less and have less problems.
Right.
And so, there's lots of factors.
Mm. Yeah. And when you look at things like affect, like mood, right, you find that people who use to cope with negative affect experience more problems, even if they drink the same as people who drink for different reasons. Right. And so basically, right, one of the big tales here, right, is like, oh, there's just an association, not surprising. But like most of the variability in consequences has nothing to do with how much you use or how often you use. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that we should, our interventions, I don't think appreciate that enough, because most of our interventions start at the use level, right? Like, let's change your use. But in fact, changing all these other factors where available. And that I think that is like an important take home, which is one of the reasons why when you asked if you just randomly grabbed a person off the street and said, what is a substance use disorder, they would tell you about use patterns. But it's not.
Yeah.
It's not that. In fact, that's one of the reasons why outside of impaired control over your use frequency and quantity almost don't show up in the criteria in any way.
Right.
All of them are problems in using despite experiencing them is almost exclusively what they are, and behavioral restrictions and alterations to feeling states like tolerance and withdrawal. And so, right. Like, I think that's one of the next frontiers I think our field really needs to move to is thinking more holistically about the person's experience and not just be like, could you cut back?
Right.
Yeah.
Cause that would be sweet. Right. And it's like, yeah, but that's like, you know, 17% of the variance. Right. Like, and so, you know, you have an additional 70% or something of variance that's unexplained by various other factors that we need to take into consideration.
Yeah.
And so that's why one of it is perhaps, you know, a better linkage between the strategies that we're using to modify their use and their actual experience of consequences, hence Mark's work. Right. But also, you know, work looking at, you know, these kind of systemic factors, you know, racism, you know, things like that, and also people's mood and social factors that all contribute to these types of things, right? Jen Reed's work that talked about this on her episode of the show. And so I think there's so much work to do here, and also so much really amazing work that has happened so far. And so that's one of the reasons why we really wanted to have you on the show is to bring our audience up to speed on what has been done, but also really to highlight, you know, what remains to be done. There's a bunch of, you know, trainees potentially listening to this show who are thinking where they should take their career. And, you know, there's my advisor once said that one person's air variance is another person's career. And so I think this is a really important point for this particular discussion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Yeah, well, I appreciate you noticing that paper. It's speaking of trainees, this was, you know, I wrote this as a postdoc, so later in my training, but still in my training. And I think this got rejected from 5 journals before it got published.
Wow.
And like reviewers basically were just like, yeah, we know this. Everybody knows this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it's not published. And I think there's value in having this out in the world as something people could publish. And, you know, just sticking with it and, you know, believing it was a little thing that needed to be out there, and even just to encourage folks to look beyond just use when trying to understand consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm glad you pursued it, because I think you're right. It needs to be published, and there just needs to be a focus on it. So yeah, thank you for that. And thank you also for everything you've brought to the podcast today. Wonderful discussion on PBS. And we're going to transition now to the take-home messages, if that's all right.
Sure, that's great.
Yeah. So first take-home message, what do you think the take-home message is for people who are trying to make a change or interested in making a change to their substance use?
Well, I think first is that change is possible and stick with it. Even if you have setbacks, keep moving forward. And also, I guess my advice would be to just sit and take a look at your life, the things that are important to you, the decisions you're making. You know, what are the things, you know, what, how is your use getting in the way of you living your best life? And then devise your plan to focus on, you know, living that life in line with your values. All the protective behavioral strategies work that I've done shows that that's really what matters. You don't need some, you know, super novel strategy no one's ever thought of. It doesn't have to be this, you know, Herculean feat. It could be something really simple, but something that fits really well in your life and your circumstances day to day. And if it doesn't work, then just try to understand why it didn't work and come up with a new one. Keep moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point, is that like this is going to be a rinse and repeat process, right? And finding one that's really efficient and potent in your life is like absolutely essential to the process. And, you know, from a relapse prevention perspective, right? Like if we, you know, don't fall, if it doesn't work the way we had hoped, like, right, we figure out where the pressure points were and move along. What would you say to practitioners that might be listening?
I think that in general, practitioners do a great job and know a lot of this stuff. I would say pause and slow down. Don't assume that just because you came up with your plan that a client knows how to do it, or that, you know, if you suggest a strategy and they're like, oh yeah, that sounds like a great strategy, that, you know, you can send them on their way. You know, brainstorm what might be the barriers. You know, could there be something you didn't expect that would throw a monkey wrench in your plans? And, you know, as a practitioner, to just take a little extra time to troubleshoot it and have a plan B, have an exit strategy. Sometimes that can make all the difference in the world for someone being, you know, meeting their goals or not meeting their goals.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. What's your take-home message for policymakers?
So for policymakers, I think ultimately, you know, it's tough. I was thinking about this with cannabis use, that use may be a bit of a red herring. That if policymakers are really interested, say, in a roadside test for, you know, for cannabis use intoxication while driving, but, you know, one sort of uncharted field in my view are tolerance studies. And, you know, really experienced cannabis people who use cannabis on cognitive tests and driving simulators tend to do pretty well. And I would encourage policymakers just to pay attention to the literature and don't get stuck, you know, don't focus too much on these use variables. And the other thing for policymakers, I think, is that substance use is a mental health problem, not a legal problem. And so, you know, I hope we can see more decriminalization like we just had here in Colorado with psilocybin, and also more resources being funneled towards treatment programs and research to really help people rather than punish them.
Yeah. Completely agree.
Absolutely.
What would you say is the take-home message for underserved populations?
You know, I think this could be a whole conversation by itself.
Yeah.
You know, in my work, we've started to balance conversations about risk with conversations about strength and resilience. I think underserved populations have a lot of untapped strengths that can be leveraged in prevention intervention programs without always focusing on risks. And I would just say, you know, to underserved populations that, you know, we see all the strengths that you have in your communities and in yourselves, and, you know, build on those.
Absolutely. All right. Well, this puts us at the end. We've got one more question for you, Mark. You've had a really successful career. You had a lot of great mentorship. So So you seem well positioned to answer this question. Do you have any advice for trainees?
Absolutely. Like you said, I've been blessed, just a long list of incredible mentors. I'm so grateful for them. And some of the lessons that they've taught me first is read as much as you can. There's no shortcut. Read research articles, read treatment manuals, read philosophy texts, anything you can get your hands on. Also know your strengths and build on them. And similarly, reach out to experts when you don't know. In science, one of the worst things you can do is pretend to know something. There are experts out there that are happy to talk to you and know the limits of your knowledge. And, you know, I can't tell you how much I've gained just from that alone, of realizing like, okay, I hit a point where I'm no longer comfortable. This is outside of my area of expertise. I'm going to reach out to someone. And people are so gracious. Folks like Jan Copeland, who've just been doing incredible cannabis research for decades, reached out to her, and she was just so kind and gracious and taught me so many things about the cannabis field as I was moving into the space from the alcohol research, that helped me not just try to go through my alcohol measures and like replace the word alcohol with cannabis, which is an easy trap to fall into. And so there are experts out there. Most of them are happy to share with you. Be persistent and resilient to rejection. And I would say, not just be open to critical feedback, but be eager for it. Like, I'm happy when I can get critical feedback, because it helps me to improve my work. And related to that, this is tough, but our profession feels very personal, but it's just a job. And, don't rely on your work to define you as a person, or these rejections will be very difficult. And there'll be lots of rejections along the way. And that's just part of it. Learning to just see it as, okay, I guess I wasn't, this may be obvious to me, but I didn't say it clear enough. And so I'm going to try again, try to say this more clearly. And then I think the last one, I just came back from ABCT, and, I have advice to go to conferences, because it's where you see the state of the science being presented, where you get to network and meet people. And more than anything, as a scientist, you can feel kind of lonely, or like you're grinding it out in some dark office and nobody cares and nobody's reading your stuff. And it can be hard to keep pushing and, screaming into the void, where going to a conference, you can find like-minded people and connect and talk and, realize other people are doing the same thing. And I think it just, one of the highlights of being in this field is getting to see people, spend time with them at conferences. So those are my advice, piece of advice for trainees.
Great advice, Mark. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for taking some time out for us and our audience.
Absolute pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you.
Yeah.